There's a disorder so common that an estimated 2 million school-age children are affected by it in the United States alone. That figure translates into one child in every classroom in this country. And that doesn't begin to take into account those in Canada and around the globe. This is Focus on the Family, and today we'll fill you in on this complex but highly treatable condition called ADD, Attention Deficit Disorder. Our host is psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, and I'm Mike Trout, and I appreciate the fact that you've joined us for another edition of our broadcast. Whether you're a parent or a Sunday school teacher or a school teacher, whatever your relationship is with young children especially, you probably come across the difficulty that we're going to get into today. This conversation has been recorded, so sit back and listen along with me as Dr. Dobson gets us started.
Well, Mike, as you very well know, we listen very, very closely to the people who write us, the people who call us, especially those who are suggesting program topics and telling us what they need to hear, because this is an interaction. Mm-hmm. We've never seen this program as a monologue or even a dialogue. We've seen it as a conversation. We talk, people respond. One of the things that we've been hearing, literally hundreds of parents have been contacting us and telling us that they need us to do another program on what's called Attention Deficit Disorder, ADD,
right,
or sometimes called Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. This difficulty has been given all kind of names through the years. Going back to the 1960s when I was in graduate school, it had about four or five different names then to it. This is the current lexicon, the current title that's given to this disorder, attention deficit disorder. Now, what it means, essentially, is a youngster who is impulsive, easily distracted, high-strung, often hyperactive, although not always, but has great difficulty keeping his mind mm-hmm. on the topic at hand. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the characteristics of it. When one of these youngsters appears in a family, he often creates serious difficulties for the family. Sibling rivalry, conflict within the home, difficulties between the mother and the father. Mm-hmm. I mean, a true ADD child can really be the most frustrating and the most difficult child to raise.
Yes, it can create a lot of stress, and it's also interesting that you say he when you refer to this person, because I understand more often than not it is a male child.
It's my understanding that as much as 6-to-1, or some people say 10-to-1, of these youngsters are boys, although it can happen in girls. Well, we're giving some of the facts that we want to hear from our distinguished panel, and we are surrounded by people who have very good reason to know and understand this problem. And I tell you, I am honored to have these folks in the studio with me. Just very quickly, let me introduce the people who are here. Some have literally flown from around the country to be here with us today, and I appreciate them doing that because all these people are busy. First of all, let me introduce my very good friend, Grant Martin. Dr. Martin regularly sees patients struggling with ADHD, and he's developed a keen interest in this area and expertise. In fact, he's written a book called The Hyperactive Child, What You Need to Know About Attention Deficit Disorder, Facts, Myths, and Treatment. I think this is the best book on the subject that's out right now, and we'll be talking about that more later. Flying in all the way from Massachusetts, I said the
good
word.
Good for you.
is Mrs. Sandra Thomas. Sandy is a former nurse and a parent of a 14-year-old ADHD son named Scott.
That's right, yes.
Also with us is Mrs. Carol Wilkerson. She's a registered nurse. She specializes in neonatal intensive care here at the Penrose Community Hospital in Colorado Springs. Her son, Matt, is now 13 but was diagnosed as ADHD as a child. Carol and her husband, Dave, have begun their own support group in their church, and they regularly have about 20 families in their community that participate. In fact, one of our producers, Lou Ann Crane, who helped with this broadcast, came to one of your support mm-hmm. groups and enjoyed it very much, Carol. Explain what happens there.
At our support group?
Uh-huh.
Well, we have, like we said, about 20 people, 20 families that come to our support group. And we do have guest speakers, but we only have a guest speaker every other month. We try to meet every month. And the reason that we only have a guest speaker every other month is because on the alternate months, the parents want to meet just together for the reason the group was formed.
To support
one another. And we do have a number of adults with attention deficit disorder in our group.
Now, when I said a few minutes ago that this disorder has a way of dividing a family mm-hmm. and really creating major problems, mm-hmm. that's why you need a support group, isn't it?
It really is. And we do have some single parents that do come to our support group, and also the number of couples. Mm-hmm. But I personally can say that it is a problem in the family, and you do need to have a common goal with mm-hmm. your spouse to handle it.
Well, let me introduce the other two guests who are here. Representing the school's role in all this is Mrs. Linda Graham. For 18 years, Mrs. Graham has worked as a special education teacher. She is our third mother present today who has an ADHD child. You have a son, don't you?
Yes, I do.
His name is Noah?
It is.
How old is he?
He is 10 years old at this time.
Huh.
And I have to smile because Noah means rest in peace, and he sure doesn't look very peaceful.
How old was he when he was diagnosed?
He was diagnosed at the beginning of first grade when he was 6 years old.
Yeah. Well, we want to hear more from all three of you who have raised an ADHD child. Finally, Dr. Patrick McCaffrey is with us. He's a pediatrician and a former chief of staff of a major hospital here in town, the Memorial Hospital. He's been in pediatrics longer than some of you have been alive. I don't know how to tell you that.
That's
28
correct.
Years, is that right?
At least.
His list of achievements would really take the rest of the broadcast to talk about. We're really honored to have him here with us. Now, one of the reasons that we've assembled such a large group in the studio here is that ADHD really requires a team approach in order to treat it and deal with it and understand it. And so we've represented the various professions that are usually involved with this kind of child and with the family who are raising one. So welcome to all of you. Now, let's tackle the problem straight on. Grant, I'm going to start with you and ask you to, and then the others just jump in. I'd like you to just describe this child. I gave kind of a cursory introduction to him, but what's he like? Explain it, especially for those who've never seen such a youngster.
They're usually pretty easy to recognize. They have trouble sitting still. There's kind of four categories of problems. One of inattention. They just can't focus on something unless it's highly interesting. Now, they can play Nintendo for hours or play with their Legos or watch cartoons. I know when I was back in grad school, I had a incorrect idea that if a child could watch a cartoon for 15 minutes or longer, he was not, at that time we called it minimal brain mm-hmm. dysfunction. And that was grossly inaccurate on my part. These kids, when it's highly stimulating, highly entertaining, they can attend to a task. But you give them math problems, you give them a spelling list, something that's kind of boring, kind of challenging in that way, and they just have trouble sticking to it, getting the paper done, getting the problems down.
Mm-hmm. It's the first time I've ever known that I'm ADHD. Mike, I have the same problem when I get bored. Not really. Explain so the extreme example of this problem.
Well, I think of a boy who sets fires, is constantly moving around, challenging his parents. He's also very gifted, very bright lad that I'm thinking of. Disagreeing, they ask him to do something and he won't do it. His emotions react. A little thing gets just a volcanic reaction. And then finally, they don't get it. That is, they don't seem to profit from consequences. It's like there's some kind of invisible wall that keeps these children from learning from their mistakes.
Which makes discipline very, very difficult.
Oh, it just makes it torture. And then it's easy after months and years of that to kind of impute some kind of evil nature, this willful, disobedient child, and maybe the devil's got him or something, and that's just not true. But it's just frustrating that you discipline, you time them out, you try every kind of reward or punishment, and they just repeat the mistake again and again and again.
Sandra, describe this child from a mother's point of view.
I'm very struck by an example when our child was young. We had visitors from out of town and thought it would be kind of fun to go to an ice cream store
and packed everyone up in the car and ran to the ice cream store with no preconceived notion of what would happen. And it was a disaster. We were expecting a child who could not inherently organize his thoughts and make choices quickly to decide between 27 flavors with 15 behind us. And it was a nightmare, a situation where he wound up in tears, we wound up in tears. It was not a very good experience. What we've learned since that time is structure, the all-important word of structure. So now when we do that, we'll say, in 5 minutes, we're going to go get an ice cream cone. You know, honey, in 2 minutes, you need to get your coat on. And by the way, you can choose between chocolate chip or strawberry. So you set them up for success. I think the one thing that's important for families is that we want very much to raise our children in the ways that we believe are important, with all of the caveats of spirituality, certainly. Certainly the core of raising them to be good citizens. It's very difficult to do when you don't understand what the problem is. One of the reasons I became involved in the support group I'm in is that I didn't know what I was supposed to do. The school didn't know what they were supposed to do, and we couldn't criticize them. They'd never been taught. And so it became very apparent that with the healthcare professionals, the teachers, and the parents working together needed to figure out what to do for this child.
Well, take us back to the time when he was a toddler and you didn't know what you had on your hands yet. I assume that it took you a while to get a diagnosis.
It took a long time.
What was it like? Did you find yourself crying?
Constantly. I was depressed. I cried a lot. I prayed a lot. I was very frustrated. My husband and I both together kept scratching our heads saying, we know that he's offline developmentally. As Grant says, he doesn't get it. He didn't quite get what he was supposed to do. No matter how much we would teach him, and as an intelligent child, he couldn't internalize that. And so we went through years of being very frustrated, being isolated, quite frankly, as a family. We're kind of good-natured souls, I think, who like to be out there and go on picnics and so forth, birthday parties. These kids aren't invited to those because they stand out in a crowd, because they don't know how to be part of a group. They don't know how to make friends, although they're friendly kids. They don't get those pieces. So what happens is a family should become more and more distant because it's embarrassing, you don't understand, and it's easier to stay at home.
Have people tell you that you needed to discipline better?
If you'd only spank him more, you know he'd behave. Yeah. We would hear this constantly. And I'd say it's not a matter of spanking him more. Frankly, we've done that, and it doesn't work. Yeah. What we need to do is understand what we need to do differently as a family, and we now have learned that we need to structure his environment to set him up for success, but we didn't know that.
Sandra, does the child move in and out of this kind of behavior?
Yes.
Or is it just constant?
It's both. And that's, I mean, if anything, it's variable. And that's the word I would use. I kept saying, it's the one thing that's consistent is that the behavior is inconsistent. And so within that, it's very frustrating that one day they seem to be able to do it, whatever it is required in the task on hand. The next day or the next minute, they simply can't. Whether it's the neurotransmitters in the brain, as we understand the medical component, I'm not quite clear on that, but that is the frustration as a family, that it looks willful. It looks, you know, as though it's intentional, and it really is not.
Carol, pick right up where Sandra left off now. You were a mother that raised a youngster like this. How old was your child when diagnosed?
We knew that there was something going on with Matt when he was very young, probably when he was 3 or 4 years old, not necessarily because he was so hyperactive, because he is just slightly hyperactive and has that tendency. However, he had very short attention span, very hard time concentrating on things, and when he did concentrate on something, when there was something he really wanted to concentrate on, like if it was a nature program on television, he would absolutely zero all of his attentions in on this. If you need to talk to him, you'd get his attention, you'd have to tap his shoulder. We knew, so we were in a way lucky, because before our son went into school, we had a feeling, we knew, and plus we had some very good friends that had a child about 5 years old. I didn't have a support group at that time to help me, but we did have a family that was very supportive that helped it, because it's, you go through a certain grieving process in realizing that your child has ADD, because you don't have that perfect child. When it came time to put Matt into kindergarten, we were prepared. We knew that he could not start kindergarten, that we had to keep him back a year. What we chose to do is to have him repeat kindergarten. He started kindergarten and he repeated. And I look at our life with Matt as just a series of major decisions that we've had to make for him.
What you're saying is that these kids have to be very carefully managed, and things that
Absolutely.
Come natural and
Yes.
easy for other families require a great deal of thought and care and professional advice.
And the decisions are very difficult to make.
Yes, they are.
Pat, talk about these youngsters from a pediatrician's point of view. They come into your office. How difficult is it to get a diagnosis? And what do you see?
Well, it's quite difficult to get a diagnosis because usually the parents are at about wit's end. Some of the mothers are in tears. Their family's about to come apart. The father and the mother are quarreling about how they should manage this child. And all the while, this child keeps whirling around. Now, they come in all sorts of boxes. Some children, you would recognize them right away. These are children who are impulsive. They're always in motion. Their mother has mentioned that they shouldn't do whatever they're doing four or five times. They've gone through all the drawers in your office. They've walked around. They picked your pocket. They've turned on all of the faucets and crawled into the wastebasket. So these aren't too hard to check out. They're usually sent by the school or a kindergarten, or the parents have attempted to enroll them in some educational endeavor, and they are told, even though they're at wit's end, that their child can't learn. You've got to do something with him. You've got to take him, do something, because you can't bring him back until his behavior is such that he can cooperate with the rest of the children. They are frequently destructive. In other words, they will dominate all of the activity, not because they want to, it's because they can't help but do that. They are, if you ask the mother and the father, they'll say, you know, he's just a klutz. He'll stumble over everything. He doesn't watch where he's going. In addition to that, we've tried to get him to write his name, and it takes the whole page to write their name. They can't stay inside the lines. As a matter of fact, they can't do hardly anything. For those fathers who are particularly bent on their sons being athletes, this is a big come down. And for many fathers for whom sons have an athletic endeavor, they're disappointed and start to yell at them. Well, these children are not well coordinated. If they had to swing a bat, they'll miss by 3 feet. They're always striking out. The coach is yelling at them, and that doesn't help at home either. It's painful if you've been a parent, and all of you here are parents of children who are ADDs. You've seen them now at the ball field. They have every good intention. They're focused on doing well. They're impulsive, and they swing before the ball gets halfway to the plate, and then they persevere. That's the most painful part of a child with ADD. They want to do it, and they're focused on what they're doing, and they fail the first time, and they fail again, and they fail again. And it's painful to watch them, because after the fifth or sixth time they fail, they have a temper tantrum or an outburst. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know what's happening to them, that's hard.
And then it becomes a self-esteem problem.
Absolutely.
Then they're rejected by the other kids and laughed at and ridiculed and not invited, Sandra, as you said.
You can do nothing right.
Mm-hmm. Jim, there's one thing that's kind of been implied in this. These kids really want to do it right.
Yes. Certainly. Yeah.
And that's part of the diagnostic procedure sometimes, as you try to separate this from oppositional disorder or other kinds of conditions, is you get a sense of whether the child really wants to follow the rules. I think of a teacher told me of this little boy. They had a speaker coming into the classroom, and the whole class was instructed, you need to listen real carefully and sit still, because if you disrupt things, you'll have to leave the room. So this little boy is sitting in his desk, and first of all, his hands start moving. So he clasps his hands on the top of his desk and try to keep his hands still. They keep moving. So then he sits on them. So he puts them under his bottom so that he could try to keep his hands still. Well, then his feet started dancing around the floor. And then to try to control his feet, he hooked them around the legs of his chair. So if you can imagine the picture now, you're sitting on your hands, you got your feet hooked around the bottom of your chair, just trying to pay attention to the speaker for all you're worth. And then his bottom started moving, jumping up and down, moving side back and forth, and in a minute, he tipped the chair over. And he was just heartbroken, in tears, as he had to leave the room.
Trying so hard. Oh, boy. Doesn't your heart go out to him?
You just see this again and again.
Yeah.
Yes, you do. That wiggliness and that squirminess and that fidgetiness, we sometimes, you know, we see that as hyperactivity. But if you can look at an ADHD child as a child who is probably trying to maintain mental alertness, that fidgetiness kind of makes sense because we forget that sitting still probably requires more energy than any single thing we do. And we require it of children all the time. We as adults don't do a good
That's
job
right.
at it.
This child can drive a teacher absolutely crazy, Kenny.
Oh, they sure can.
Grant, in your book, The Hyperactive Child, you list 10 things to do with a pencil if you're ADHD. I think this is good. There are 10 things you can do with it. One, you can blow it across your desk. You can fly it through the air. You can hold it high in the air and drop it. You can stick it in the screws of the chair. You can thread it through your belt loops. You can pick the threads of your socks. You can roll it inside your desk. You can poke your neighbor. You can sharpen it. You can resharpen it. And you can lose it. 10 things you can do with it.
Nowhere on that list is you can write it.
That's right.
No, and these children are interesting because they develop an alternative behavior. They really can't do the work, but yet they can gain attention. And many times they'll be a class clown. They're able to do something well, which will attract everybody else's attention, which diverts the teacher from teaching students and entertains the rest of them. Mm-hmm. So that these children have an alternative behavior which allows them to do what they're doing but yet not learn. Mm-hmm. But they're bright.
And it diverts them also from doing the task at hand, which is so hard for them to do.
That's correct.
And so this is the one thing they can do. And it's funny, I hear day after day, these kids are funny. They've got a great sense of humor, and as Grant says, they want to do well, and they truly do. They're good-natured kids, and they're neat kids, but they do struggle so much with every avenue of their life where they're asked to perform. It's really a performance problem.
And they're often very bright. Let's get
often,
that understood. I've read that Einstein may well have been an ADHD. Mm-hmm. And there are other examples.
Einstein's a good example because I really believe, who's to say that distractibility doesn't become creativity someday?
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that was true with Einstein, and that hyperactivity doesn't become drive as an adult. And a child's inability, an ADHD child's inability to allocate his attention to some tasks but over-allocate his attention to other tasks won't allow him to someday become an expert in one area, but certainly a very, very good expert in that area. So I think that we have to also recognize that these things we're trying to fix, these weaknesses, the potential is that they will someday become strengths for this child.
Parents should not see this kid as damaged goods. It's really important to get that across, right?
Absolutely not. And if you can keep that creativity and that spark alive and keep their self-esteem intact, then you're going to have something. When they become adults, they do become these really unique, creative individuals.
I was just talking to a client who I described without his name in the book. We were playing the memory game. It's a concentration, it's known by different things, where you lay a bunch of cards or figures out on the floor, and you find the matching pair. You turn one picture over, one card over in the line of cards, and you turn another one over, and if the two match, you get to pick up the card. Well, Paul beat me when we played that game like 30-2. Now, here was a fourth grade boy. Now, I have a PhD, for crying out loud. I'm going to let a fourth grade boy just... But he did. I did not have the visual memory that even came close to this fellow.
Let me match you. another psychologist and I were dealing with this Down syndrome child who also was an attention deficit disorder youngster and very hyperactive. And we were in an adjoining office. Well, this kid, who was only about 6 years old, runs into the other psychologist's office, climbs up on his desk, picks up the phone, and hands it to him. Well, to humor him, he put the phone to his ear. And then the kid runs back in my office and climbs on my desk and picked up my phone and handed it to me. Well, I put it to my ear and acted like I was talking. It so happened that the two phones were connected. This kid had the two psychologists talking to each other with nothing to say. And he had tied us both in knots. It's really interesting how a youngster with this difficulty can just scramble everything.
Well, I think we all know children who can do that to us. I'm Mike Trout. We're back in our Focus on the Family studios. We're playing for you today a recording of a series of conversations, actually, with a panel of guests on this subject of attention deficit disorder. We'll continue for the next two broadcasts dealing with this subject. I hope you can be with us, and I hope you'll pass the word along to others. I know we are reaching out to many parents who are having some form of learning difficulty with their children, and it may be attention deficit disorder. Let them know that this broadcast is on the air on a regular basis. Our guests are Dr. Grant Martin, Sandra Thomas, Carol Wilkerson, Linda Graham, and Dr. Patrick McCaffrey. We'll hear from them when Focus on the Family returns. This program is provided on a regular basis by Focus on the Family. Our host is psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, and I'm Mike Trout, looking forward to having you back when we'll again turn our hearts toward home.